Every once in a while, I have guests who simply appear on a podcast schedule. I reach out, they accept, they come on, and we have a great conversation. Longtime listeners will know that sometimes they come on more than once. But on the other end of that spectrum, I have guests that I've spent years chasing. In case you're wondering, up next is the second kind. For nearly a decade, I've hoped tonight's conversation would happen. Emails were sent, introductions were made, all while expeditions were launched and life was happening. Through all of it, though, one name remained high on my list. In fact, he's so important to this show and to the project I've been running for over a decade now that I've always held out hope just in case he ever decided to change his mind. Well, tonight, I'm proud to say, project complete. If you spent any amount of time studying the disappearance of Amelia Earhart and Fred Noonan, chances are you've encountered his work, whether you realized it or not. His fingerprints are all over one of the most ambitious chapters in the search for Earhart's Lockheed Electra. He's an engineer, an explorer, a deep ocean pioneer, an inventor, and a best-selling author. Perhaps most importantly for this audience, he's someone who spent decades doing something that very few people on Earth are even capable of doing. When we talk about the Earhart mystery, it's easy to get caught up in eyewitness testimony, historical documents, radio signals, photographs, or competing theories. But beneath all of those discussions lies one simple reality. If Amelia Earhart and Fred Noonan crashed into the Pacific Ocean, then somewhere, more than 18,000 feet down beneath the surface, they may still be waiting. Finding something in the deep ocean isn't like searching for a needle in a haystack. It's searching for a needle buried beneath miles of darkness on a planet we've explored less than the surface of the moon. Think about that. That is the world tonight's guest lives in. For decades, he's led expeditions into some of the deepest and most unforgiving environments on the face of the Earth. As the founder of Nauticos, he helped build one of the world's premier deep ocean exploration organizations, developing technology and search methodologies that have been used to locate everything from historic shipwrecks to modern aircraft and long-lost vessels resting thousands of feet below the sea. His career has taken him around the globe in pursuit of history hidden beneath the ocean floor. He's worked alongside governments, researchers, engineers, and explorers, solving problems that most of us couldn't even begin to imagine. And when it comes to Amelia Earhart, he's become one of the leading voices behind what has become known as the crash and sink hypothesis. The theory itself is elegantly simple. Earhart and Noonan reach Howland Island's vicinity, but never find it. Eventually, fuel runs out and the Electra enters the Pacific Ocean, relatively intact. It sinks into water so impossibly deep that for generations it remains completely beyond humanity's ability to reach. But a simple explanation doesn't always equal an easy task, because proving or disproving that theory requires something almost unimaginable, mapping thousands upon thousands of square miles of the ocean floor, separating natural geology from man-made objects, developing technology capable of surviving crushing pressures, and having the patience to spend years, sometimes decades, following clues that may or may not lead you anywhere at all. Tonight's guest has devoted an extraordinary amount of his life to that pursuit. He's also chronicled those adventures in books that combine science, exploration, and the human drive to answer questions that refuse to stay unanswered. Because that's really what this mystery has always been about. Not simply finding an airplane, but understanding two people. Understanding one July morning in 1937, and understanding what happened after those final radio transmissions echoed across the Pacific. Whether you agree with Crash and Sink, whether you lean towards Nikumaroro, Japanese capture, or possibly something else entirely, one thing is undeniable. David Jordan has done the work. He's gone to sea, he's built the technology, he's assembled the teams. He stared into the abyss and asked it to give up one of history's greatest secrets. And now, as Nauticos prepares for another ambitious chapter in their search, the timing couldn't be better. Tonight, we'll talk about the science behind searching an ocean that covers nearly a third of our planet. We'll discuss what we've learned after decades of exploration. And we'll examine where previous searches may have gone wrong. We'll ask whether modern technology has finally reached the point where this mystery can be answered once and for all. And yes, after waiting for 10 years to have this conversation, I've got a few questions I've been saving. So whether you're listening from halfway around the world, or just discovering the Amelia Earhart mystery for the very first time, settle in. You picked a hell of a time to start the chase, but you couldn't have picked a better person to start it with. Because when someone who spent a lifetime exploring the last greater frontier joins us, you don't waste that opportunity. Welcome back to Chasing Earhart. From Nauticos HQ in Kennebunkport, Maine, this is David Jordan. And we are live. Mr. David Jordan. It's been 10 years. Welcome to the show.
Well, thanks, Chris. I appreciate it. I'm looking forward to finally making an appearance.
Yeah, absolutely. Your name has been dropped countless times on this show, especially in this rebrand, as we've been talking to all these folks that are doing all these different searches. You've spent 30 years on this case, roughly. We'll let you talk about it here in a moment, but you've spent a long time. 30 years chasing a target smaller than a house in an ocean the size of a continent. At what point, for you, does persistence become faith?
Well, I tell you, I certainly, when we began, I certainly didn't anticipate that I'd be on Medicare and Social Security and still working at it. When we initially contemplated doing this project, when we met Elgin Long way back in the late 90s, we had, by early 2000, had a string of successes of deep sea discoveries. And every project we set out to search, we found the target in the first expedition.
Yeah.
And in some cases, like in the case of the I-52, 20 miles almost from where it was thought to be, but it was where we thought it was.
Yeah.
So I remember saying to my staff at the time, we need to try a harder project. I guess I kind of regret those words because I got what I was asking for. This is a tough one.
Because
of the size of the target and the size of the search area and the depth and the remoteness of the area.
Yeah, well, let's expand on that. It's a great segue. Do you ever regret choosing Earhart as the mountain that you wanted to try to climb?
I have no regrets whatsoever. We've had some amazing times pursuing this. We've accomplished a lot. I've recently been in touch with the folks at NOAA who have expressed their appreciation for the data that we've collected and given to them over the years.
Yeah.
Not many organizations have surveyed such a large contiguous area of the deep sea at such a resolution. And that's got to be, you know, helpful in the long run to humanity in some way.
Sure.
I am surprised as anyone that we haven't succeeded in finding the plane yet. I still believe it's there. But I have to admit, in retrospect, it was a bigger, more of a daunting project than I expected.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, let's go back a little bit. When you first enter the Earhart world and you're thinking about this, did you see yourself then, or maybe now, did you see yourself solving a mystery or correcting a mythology, so to speak?
When we first were introduced to this project, which was by Elgin Long and WGBH folks who want to do a documentary about it.
Yeah.
It was in the context of, can we give our opinion on the validity of this theory that Elgin had? That was really what we were asked to do. We weren't asked to go do a search or anything like that. And it was only after we heard the theory and talked to Fred Kulik, the fellow that did the fuel calculation and did our own research, that we said, hey, this is really an interesting project. We think we can find that plane. And it would be really a great business opportunity, you know, because that's what we were. We were a business and we weren't going to just go do things for fun. As much fun as our business is, we had to have some expectation of making our money back on it. So we looked at the potential of media exposure. And at that time, we were only really dimly aware of the exhibition potential. But, you know, there have been some other things like the Hunley submarine that was discovered off of the Carolinas where there was some potential for exhibition. Of course, Titanic was a big deal. So what we did was we sat down and spent a couple of years both doing the analytical research to try to figure out what happened and where to search and how big of a problem we had. And also to figure out what the business opportunity really was. You know, what were the things that we could do once we found the plane to make a return on our sizable investment, and B, very quickly we realized that it wasn't worth doing unless we were going to have a bigger mission as well. what was the legacy of Amelia Earhart that we were going to hope to share with the world. And also we were interested in education. It seemed like a great opportunity to promote STEM and to get young people, young women in particular, involved in engineering and so on. So there were many components that made it a compelling project to us. I don't think, considering your way you formed the question, that it was really so much of trying to correct a misconception about her. I mean, we were really not that steeped in the mystery to begin with. You know, we'd heard of Amelia Earhart, who hadn't, but it wasn't something we had really, most of us had really studied.
Yeah.
So we only became aware of the controversies and the different theories as time went on. And you can't help but becoming kind of involved in what do they mean and how do they relate to what you're doing.
Yeah. Well, and you know, you just talked about a lot of very good reasons to get into this and a lot of good reasons that have kept you going. What is the Earhart case taken from you, maybe, that the public would never see?
Well, I can't really come up off the top of my head with anything I consider a sense of loss. Obviously, we've invested a lot of time and money. You know, I could have made personally more of a living if I had devoted that time to some other pursuit that someone was willing to pay me for. So, you know, if you add up all the hours that we've spent, not just me personally, of course, because it's a team effort. We have put in a lot of effort that some folks may consider has been squandered, I suppose. Could have done something better with our time. Of course, I could say the same thing about people, you know, watching sports or, you know, laying on the couch. You know, I certainly could tally up the cost of time and money and say, well, you know, it's too bad. If we never succeed in this, that would obviously be a loss. But in terms of psychologically, I think it's really been much more of a positive. The people that I have had the privilege of working with, you've interviewed them all, I think, Jeff and Rod and Tom and now Amelia Rose and Bill Mills and Jeff Palshuk. And, you know, I hate to leave anybody out, but all the crew of Nauticos over the years that has worked on this and continues to work on it. The teamwork has been a real privilege to be associated with. I can't really think of anything to tell you that would be a regret.
Fair enough. Well, and you know, you're known as a data guy, but this case, you know, it's emotional, tribal, almost religious for some people. Has that surprised you over the years?
Well, it's something we've come to learn and appreciate that people are willing to pursue a line of inquiry that really isn't well supported by the facts, but yet it's ingrained in them. And you have to always look for that in yourself. Are you following this particular idea because you believe in the idea or because the idea is supported by the facts? People in all walks of life have that dilemma, and we see it all the time. You know, that's certainly been something that has grown on us. As I said, we didn't really know much about all these different theories when we first looked at the data and said, what does the data tell us?
Sure.
In fact, we did talk to Rick Gillespie early on. He was interested in us doing some motion search near Nikumaroro.
Sure.
And we didn't really think that seemed like a plausible thing to pursue. So we, you know, politely declined. I can't remember exactly when that was, but long time ago.
Yeah.
And it wasn't until we heard something that sounded really fact-based and plausible that could be analyzed that we really took an interest.
We talk a lot on the show about failure. And in 2002, 2006, 2017, you guys have had several expeditions. People that look at that say, well, that's a failure if you don't show up with the plane. What did those expeditions teach you? Those experiences out on the deep ocean, what did that teach you that you can now take into this expedition in hopes of finally putting this to bed and finally locating her aircraft?
Well, we have a lot of experience in deep ocean search, both with the projects that everybody knows about that are on our website and a lot of stuff we've done with the Navy over the years that we don't put on our website. One of the things that I learned early on, and folks like Tom Detweiler and Jeff Morris and others have reinforced, or I learned from them, is every expedition you do has an objective. Of course, finding what you're looking for is the overarching objective, but you can't lose sight of your first objective is to come back with coverage of an area that you can eliminate from your search. So if you go out there and kind of do a scattershot, look here, look there, chase this idea, chase that idea, and at the end of the day, you're not really sure exactly what you eliminated, you've wasted your time. We've always been very methodical. So we cover areas, we close them out. We can never be 100% certain of anything, but we try to be 98, 99% certain that what we're looking for isn't in that area. And then we move on. When we come back, we study that data just to second guess ourselves and say, gee, did we miss something? Is this an area that we have to go back and look at again because, you know, the sonar performance was less than it should have been? Terrain was rougher than we thought, whatnot. So obviously, I don't consider expeditions to be failures.
Sure.
In the sense of we collected valuable information that adds to our understanding of where to look the next time. That's the way we have to look at it. Now, if you go out there and if you're trying to cover so much area in a short period of time, you don't have a high probability of detection, you know, that is, you might miss it. Then when you come back, you really haven't proved that it isn't there. So that would be, I would consider a waste of time.
Yeah. To piggyback off of that, how much of the search is science and how much is probability management at this point?
Well, it always was a probability problem. When Elgin originally presented it to us, he, you know, as an accident investigator said, here's what I think she was doing, and here are all the other possibilities, and given the speed and fuel, et cetera, it could be anywhere in this 8,000 mile square mile box, 8,000 square mile box. And we always knew that was an impractical amount of terrain to search.
Yeah.
Certainly back in the early 2000s, you know, one could do a square nautical mile an hour, maybe at best, that's that adds up. So it's always been a question of, yeah, sure, it could be anywhere in there, but where is it really likely to be? That's always been, in all of our searches, it's always been the question. And how do you identify the area of highest probability? And it's a mathematical problem, and it's a problem that's based on the data you have, the assumptions that you must make. This particular problem, you pointed out in the very beginning, yes, it's a small target. It's also one that there are very few facts. There's very little data to work with. So you have to make a lot of assumptions.
Yeah.
And those assumptions lead to lower probabilities in larger areas. One classic example that I like to use is on Amelia's next to last transmission. She said, I'm flying north and south in 157337. Well, that's excellent to know. 157337 is a really important clue. But, you know, Miss Amelia, are you going north or south right now? It makes a difference.
Yeah.
There's two different assumptions you have to make because nothing she said tells us if she was going north or south at that moment. So you have to do one scenario where she's going north and one where she's going south. And every step of the way, you have to make those kind of assumptions and each one snowballs on the other to expand the search area. Nonetheless, there is areas of higher probabilities than others based on everything you do. And, you know, through several different methods that we've employed that tend to be in agreement with each other, we have been methodically pursuing what we believe to be the most likely areas, followed by the next most likely, followed by the next most likely. And that's what we're doing. So one of the things that we're always second guessing ourselves is, yes, when we use a Monte Carlo or when we use a straight probability analysis of the navigation systems and when we use a RENAV approach, yes, they all tend to agree with each other. Is that because we've given them the same wrong information or does it truly represent the reality of the problem? The only way to ultimately tell is to find the plane.
Then we'll know. We had Tony Romeo on the show from Deep Sea Vision back when they very nice guy, sweetheart of a guy, very knowledgeable. And we had him on when they made the announcement, and we had him on when they had the result of the sonar image and what we were all looking at for so long. You have searched enough seafloor to know that the ocean lies visually. But what I want to ask you is, what is a false positive like what Deep Sea Vision had, What does a false positive like that do to a team psychologically if it turns out that what you had or what you thought you had isn't as important as you thought it was?
Well, you know, you try to be, if you're true to your team, you try to be realistic.
Mm-hmm.
We've had other things that we've seen, nothing quite as fetching as that image that mm-hmm. Tony had.
Sure.
We try to kind of manage our enthusiasm given the uncertainties, and nobody, you know, can walk away from a sonar contact and say, oh, I know what that is, if you have any experience at all. So it's easy for some of the less experienced people on our team to get excited about something, and then we have to tamp that down. Now, you know, we can't, until we can collect this, that, or the other information, we can't mm-hmm. say anything more than this is a target, and we can give it a quality likelihood. And we have to do that because you find sonar does pick up stuff all the time. There's rocks out there. There's occasional, not many, mm-hmm. but occasional bits of man-made flotsam. Jetsam is things you automatically, you know, purposely throw away. But mm-hmm. Every one of those may deserve further investigation, and you don't really have the time or resources to look at everything. So you have to mm-hmm. prioritize and say, well, this clearly not it because it's not the right size or other factors. It looks like it's part of the local geology. So let's not waste our time mm-hmm. studying that one. But this other one has got some anomalies. It has, you know, we have a little score sheet that we use that say, oh, this is a promising target.
Yeah.
We've never found anything out there that was so promising that we were willing to get so excited about that, you know, we would go to the press and say, hey, we found this. Mm-hmm. Let's, until you get a visual image,
mm-hmm.
it really is not, it's not identified.
Let's move to a different type of evidence. The new radio work, it's being framed as a breakthrough. What do you know in 2025, 2026 that you genuinely did not know 10 years ago when it comes to the radio part?
Well, in the original analysis, we always suspected some things. We mm. suspected that she, Amelia, was very close at the 8 o'clock transmission when the signal strength was written down as a 5+, and Leo Bellart said he would step outside of the radio room to listen for engines, but we didn't know how close. At all the other transmissions, what she was transmitting on 3105, we had an increasing signal strength, so we could tell that she was probably getting closer,
mm-hmm.
but we didn't really have a good idea of how close or how far. That then is where the Collins radio folks came into play,
mm-hmm.
and they have very cleverly analyzed those signals. And again, you have to make assumptions because nobody really knows what an S4, S5, S3, what that really is in signal
to noise
ratio.
Yeah.
So they've done some very clever work with a lot of people, including vintage radio experts, to try to quantify that. And then, of course, they've got to use models of the propagation across the ocean and models of the noise and models of the radios and models of the antennas. And they've done all that, and they'd come up with some numbers. You know, here's roughly how far she was at this time within this uncertainty and so on. And that was sort of helpful, very helpful, because mm-hmm. it's the only real primary evidence that we have.
Right.
There's nothing else that tells us what she was doing. We know what she was trying to do. She's trying to fly to Hallett Island, but we don't even know how she was making that approach. Was she flying straight in? Was she doing an offset approach? We don't know. Nothing in her planning that has survived, you know, the chronicling or in her transmissions tell us how she was planning to approach the island. So those radio signals were clearly very important.
Mm-hmm.
But all the quantification of it was based on lots of assumptions that we had to make because we just didn't have a way to actually transmit those signals until 2020. And then in 2020, and as I believe you've probably already covered it fairly extensively with the radio guys, we actually managed to put together an end-to-end antenna to radio to transmission to radio to or antenna to radio equipment on as near as we could make it identical configurations in the air and on the sea. And then we just flew them and tested them and measured
them.
So what we learned from that that we didn't know before was more quantitative rather than qualitative. You know, we kind of knew what was going on there, but we needed better numbers. And so all the 3105 transmissions, we were able to tighten down our range estimate. There's still assumptions you have to make because you really don't know what the noise level on the Itasca was. And really, there have to be some uncertainties. But the one thing that we really are excited about is the one transmission that she said she heard the Itasca at 8 o'clock when she said, on 7,500 kilohertz, she heard them, even though she couldn't get a bearing. I'm not totally qualified like the radio guys to exactly explain everything about that. But the gist of it is the frequency she was using was not the right frequency for that equipment, for that scenario. And therefore, in order for her to hear them at all, she had to be very close. And we could quantify that by the test we did. When you look at that number and the visual range of the island and a few other constraints, that tells us where she was within a very low uncertainty at 8 o'clock. So now we just have to figure out what the heck did she do for the other 40 some minutes that she flew around going on 157337 north and south, whatever. So you really constrain the problem that way. What we concluded from the analytical work that's followed those collecting the test data back in 2020 is we're still confident that we were on the right track to begin with. If we had to start all over again with what we know now, and again, we don't know how she approached the island. To digress a moment, Elgin Long was convinced that she did a northern offset approach. In other words, using celestial navigation, she flew off the direct path to the north to reach the line of position 157337, turned right and flew down that line.
Yeah.
When she couldn't find the island, then all bets are off. But he was convinced she did that, and with good reason. However, there are two other options. One is that she flew straight in and said, basically, hey, Fred, we're out of gas. We're never going to find this island by messing around. We got to fly straight in and hope to get that radio bearing that she clearly was desperate to get with every message. And she could have also done a south offset approach, which some people have argued has merit because there's actually another island down there, Baker, and you'd have chances of seeing that. But we just don't know. We have to keep those assumptions alive. But if you do that analysis and forget about where we've already searched, the most likely area still turns out to be to the northwest. But we've looked there. So I think we've pretty well proved that she did not do the north offset approach.
Yeah.
However, having searched all that area, we have eliminated a lot of ground that would have also been possible from the other approaches. So what's left is less than what we've already searched.
Right.
And we believe that with the newer capabilities that are available today with autonomous vehicles and multiple vehicle operations, we can cover everything that's left in one expedition.
In one expedition. And let's talk a little bit about that. And let's talk about a very fun curveball that Nauticos threw at the world. Let's talk a little bit about bringing Amelia Rose on board. Bringing her on to the team, it's, you know, it's powerful branding, you know, whether it's intentional or not. But how has that experience been bringing her aboard? She's been doing an awful lot of legwork in getting Nauticos out there in social media and getting people talking about this case and talking about this forthcoming expedition. Talk about bringing Amelia Rose on board and talk about how that process was for you.
Well, I'd love to, because Amelia has been a real tremendous addition to the team. Not only is she a pilot, a very smart young woman. Of course, everybody seems young to me at my age, but she's proved herself as a capable, both from fundraising and engineering and piloting and all that. And she's also just a really nice person. You know, I have really enjoyed getting to know her, and we've spent a little bit of time together, and it's fun. We have weekly meetings that she's a part of, and she's always got something to entertain us with that she's been working on. I met Amelia electronically, not in person, back when we were about to embark on our 2006 expedition.
Yeah.
And she, by then, at that time, I guess she was in her 20s, and she hadn't done that round-the-world flight yet. She was just Amelia Rose Earhart. At that time, I think she was led to believe that she was related to the famous Amelia Earhart.
Sure.
But I was interested in bringing her along on the 2006 expedition, but I wasn't really in charge. Ted Waite was the funder of that.
That's
and
right.
He called the shots. As he said, because of the uncertainties in her pedigree and all that, that it could be a negative publicity thing. That's what he was concerned about. So I really wasn't. I thought she would have been a great addition as an educational representative. You know, she was
agreed.
I thought the positives far outweighed any imaginary negatives, but that's the way that they thought about it for whatever reason. So I had to unfortunately let her know that we couldn't bring her along. And she took that information maturely, and that was that. We really kind of lost touch for the ensuing years. And then she did her round the world flight and got it back in the news again. And she and Rod Bloxam found themselves at the same conference together and got to talking. And Rod came back and said to me, gee, you know, we ought to get back in touch with Amelia Rose, because she's kind of been involved in the searches and she's talked to all the people. And I think she is really interested in what we're doing. So I talked to her, and I had to admit that we couldn't hire her because we're all really working as volunteers at this point. She said, no worries. She said, I am happy to be a member of the team. Working with you helps me with my career. And I believe in you guys anyway, and I want to help. So that's the basis that we have come to be teammates. I'm always delighted when she can use that association to her own benefit. And it certainly has benefited us.
Yeah.
But to me, she's on the team. You know, she's a, she's a principal member of the team.
Yeah, absolutely. Shout out to Amelia Rose Earhart. If this expedition doesn't work out, doesn't go the way you hope it will go, after all the renewed attention and the hope, what does that do to Nauticos, if anything?
I've always considered this to be an ambition, not an obsession. And I don't consider my career will have been a failure if I think the more likely thing is that rather than not finding it was another expedition, is that we'll never raise the money to get another expedition going, because you just never know,
which is fair.
It's hard.
We're in the same boat.
If that at some point comes to pass, I won't consider my career to have been a failure. And it's always worth it to try. When I had a large staff and we were working down in Maryland, I used to tell the gang, you want to be up to bat with the bases loaded. You might strike out. You might hit a ground ball, a double play, whatever, but you want that chance. And that's kind of what this represents to me. It's a chance to get up to bat with the bases loaded, because you could hit a home run.
Yeah, you sure as hell could. And we're all pulling for you. Absolutely. We'll have a little bit of fun as we wrap up and get out of here tonight. You know, Tiger, Nika Maroro, Japanese Capture, Buka, Deep Sea Vision, Irene Bolam, let's name them all. All these competing theories that are out there that have, some have been out for a very, very long time. Some have a lot of very compelling evidence. They certainly have a lot of fans and a lot of different camps. Does all of that frustrate you at this point in your career, or does all of that really just sort of sharpen the field?
I think there probably have been times where we felt a little frustrated by attention that some of these other things have gotten, because there's the idea that they might take potential funding away from you because there's this competing interest. That's the only thing that's really bothered me about it. You know, you were wondering why it's taken me so long to be on this podcast. And I think when you first asked me about it, I didn't know it was 10 years ago, but I believe you. I declined, hopefully politely, because I really have resisted getting involved in shows that treat everybody as coming from the same basis of fact.
Sure.
And I don't like to be in a position of debunking other people's theories, because after all, we're all explorers. I can tell you why I ardently believe in what we're doing. If pressed, I can tell you why I find the other theories to be extraordinary and without strong factual foundation, you know.
Sure.
But I don't really want to be in a position of telling Rick Gillespie he shouldn't be doing what he's doing. He should. He should. If he believes in what he's doing, he should prove it.
Yeah.
But I would expect him to come up with really strong evidence to back up what he believes, rather than a lot of noise about things that are not that compelling.
I totally get it. Speaking of Rick Gillespie and speaking of Nika Maroro, since we're talking about, that's where we'll stay. What do you think Nika Maroro, where do you think Castaway, what do you think it gets emotionally right, even if you believe it gets the evidence wrong? Does their passion for keeping Earhart in the news, Does that help you guys in some case?
That's a good point that I should have brought up, because we always say that to each other. We say, well, the good thing is that this just proves that the legend is still alive and the quest is still viable. People still care.
Sure.
You know, all you have to do is put a picture of Nikamaru in color on the web, and people are like, oh my God, you know,
Right. I hear you.
And of course, you know, a lot of times I get, didn't they find her already?
Right. Yeah. I get those emails 3 or 4 times a week. Yeah.
So I think the fact that other people are searching and following their own paths is fine. And I encourage them to do so. Of course, until I find something, I can't really throw too many stones at other people. But I would look forward to someday having found the plane and proving where it is, examining how those other theories arose in spite of the evidence and how ardently people supported them. Because it's an interesting psychological study. Until you have the proof one way or the other, it's kind of hard to argue it.
We'll step away from Nikamaru. Let's go even further. I've been very, very public at helping Bill Snavely figure out what is at Buka, what that aircraft is at Buka. What piece of evidence could come out of Buka that would make you get on an airplane tomorrow?
Well, it would have to be a pretty extraordinary piece of evidence, because the idea that it got there is extraordinary.
Yeah.
So we know so much about this plane. I mean, I've got the engineering, the blueprints. We ought to be able, if we find an actual piece of that plane, any number of parts, we ought to be able to identify it at the very least as an Electra. As far as I know, there are no known Electras that have gone down over there. So that would be pretty compelling. I think that's what you got to have a piece of the plane. I mean, it's easy enough to say.
Engine.
I think if you had a piece of the plane, or gosh, the engine, you know, which even in that environment ought to have survived, at least in some form.
Yeah.
That should be pretty easy to connect. And we fielded a lot of questions over the years about the survivability of the plane and the deep sea and all that stuff. And, you know, I used to tell people we won't know till we find it what's left. But I'm encouraged by the fact that we've found, you know, aircraft from the Lexington in World War II that are practically unblemished in that environment, made of the same material, you know. So what would survive in the jungle is a whole different story, but it would certainly be not the same.
You know, one of the things I wanted to touch on, or just, I guess, turn into a question is, you know, your books are called Never Forgotten. Is this search, your upcoming expedition, the search in general, if you want to go broad spectrum, is it really about finding an airplane, or is it about making sure that the lost are not erased?
Oh, it's all about the person, Amelia Earhart. Finding the plane is the vehicle she was in. It's it's a way to visually connect with her. To me, it's all about person. If we're able to find the plane and we raise it and exhibit it, it'll be in the context of Amelia and her exploits and her really amazing career, short as it was. In fact, I just finished Lost, Rachel Hartigan's book.
Yeah, sure.
Excellent. I don't know if you've seen it yet.
I have. Yeah. She was on the show. Yeah, I've read it. I had the pleasure of getting an advanced copy to read before I sat down with her.
Oh, nice. Nice. Yeah, that's a great book. And I think she did a really good job of communicating the story of Amelia without getting into so many arduous details. She gave you a good sense of who that woman was and what she accomplished. And I think that's something that we could help in a unique way to share by actually finding the plane.
If Nauticos finds NR-16020, who owns that moment, do you think? Science, history, the Earhart family, Purdue, the U.S. government, the public? Talk a little bit about the ownership of that moment.
Well, owning the moment as opposed to owning the artifact, I think you're looking at two
very different things.
I'm a teamwork guy. Without naming other explorers, there tends to be the sense that whoever was leading the thing is the person, usually the man. Some explorers really promote that idea, and I'm not that way. This isn't the Dave Jordan show. It isn't even really the Nauticos show, because Nauticos has been supported by so many other people. Who knows who will fund this next expedition? They're going to have to come up with $8 or $10 million to make it happen. that's not an insignificant contribution to the endeavor. And, you know, going back, Dana Timmer, who you've had on your show, I believe, he managed to launch the first deep sea expedition. And I talk to him every couple weeks. And although we have been rivals in the past, in a sense, I consider him to be a cohort now. You know, the folks that worked with him, like Mike Williamson, you know, they've contributed, and Mike worked with us on the Dakar project. And so we, you know, we have mm-hmm. that connection. And of course, all the funders, all the people that put money into our first expedition, all the team that built the Nomad, and the Navy who helped us with some of the equipment. And
a lot of people involved in this.
You know, there's you know, I mean, I could probably fill a book with the list of all the names and organizations that have made this happen. The families have not been much involved in the search. Mm-hmm. For the most part, they've been supportive or ambivalent. No one's really said, don't do it. And I think they'll be delighted, for the most part, to know what happened.
Yeah.
Generally, families are. They want to know what happened. And they deserve to share in that moment as well, for obvious reasons. You know, and even guys like Rick Gillespie, who have helped to keep this project alive, you know, I've sometimes thought what we would say to each other, you know, when one of us comes with the answer. I hope I'll be as gracious as I would hope he would be. Anyway, Elgin Long, gosh, you know, I'm sorry he's not around yet. You know, will not be around to see it all end. So anyway, it's a team effort. We can all share in the success. We all share in the endeavor so far, and I probably would not still be doing this if it wasn't for Rod Bloxham and Tom Vinson and Jeff Morris and now Amelia Rose and all those people that say we've got to keep after it, and I'm willing to help. I appreciate the question because it really made me think about a little bit more about all those people that have made this possible.
Absolutely. I hear you, and I definitely understand where you're coming from. Final question of the night. And we'll go the opposite. Mm-hmm. We just talked about how it will feel and what you'd like to see happen if the plane was found. If you don't find it, after all the math, all the expeditions, all the years, all of the hope, what should the Earhart world do? Do we keep going? Do you want this case to continue until somebody brings finality to this story?
Oh, sure. I do think the plane is out there. I think it'll be viable for decades and decades to come. In my opinion, the artifact will survive. We can't know until it's found, but I think it's there. You know, it's certainly possible that no one will come forth with the means for Nauticos to continue, but I hope somebody does. You know, we have a whole library of unpublished research and analysis, like especially the radio analysis work. And there's some, I think, more than 24 fairly meaty technical reports that are in our archive. And so I've talked to the guys, you know, maybe you guys should just publish this stuff and then you'll get the credit that you deserve. No, they say, we need to keep it close until we have our chance to find the plane. And I said, fine. But I would hope that if it comes down to it, that they do publish it and get credit for all the work they've done and that somebody else could take advantage of it. Everything we do is shared with Noah and all that. And hopefully it will contribute to something in the end.
And where can people go if they want to contribute, if they want to fund this project out of pocket, angel investors? Where do you want to let's send them somewhere. Where do we send them, Mr. Jordan? Where do we send them?
you can go to nauticos.com, N-A-U-T-O, you can't see me, but N-A-U-T-I-C-O-S.com. There's a Facebook page by the same name and can start from there. My email and phone number are on there, so give me a call.
You're not a hard man to find. All right. Well, you know, hey, it took us 10 years, but persistence paid off. David, thank you so much.
Okay, well, hopefully it won't be 10 more before we have something else to talk about.
I appreciate you, man. Thanks for coming on the show.
Okay, take care.
This is Chris Williamson, and thank you for listening to this episode of Chasing Earhart. We hope you've enjoyed the show. Please visit us on social media, where we post each new episode as it airs, news, show information, and group discussion. Go to facebook.com/ChasingEarhart, and on Twitter and Instagram, search the handle @ChasingEarhart. Reviews are crucial to the show. If you enjoyed this episode, please head to Apple Podcasts to rate us and leave us a review. It really does help get the word out. Your editor and host for Chasing Earhart is me, Chris Williamson. The show is produced by my wife, Vanessa Williamson, with music by Dane Jarris Schmidt. The opinions on Chasing Earhart are those of the individual guests and may not reflect those of Madhouse Films Incorporated. Madhouse Films Incorporated is not affiliated with the films or clips referred to herein. All clips and audio used in the podcast are the intellectual property of their respective copyright holders. They are included here for the purposes of historical entertainment and education, and no infringement is ever intended. Chasing Earhart is an exclusive trademark of Madhouse Films Incorporated and may not be used without the express written consent of Madhouse Films Incorporated. All rights reserved. Chasing Earhart is a Madhouse Films production. All rights reserved.